introductions can sometimes be difficult.
And this is definitely going to be difficult.
So, this podcast comes from our shared love of movies and also talking about movies.
And rewatching movies and introducing each other to new movies that we may not have seen or missed.
Yeah, because there's a lot of movies that I've seen that Hamza hasn't seen and vice versa.
And by him, he means Luke. So it's Luke and Hamza. And we'll be joined by a guest each week. That's an intro, right?
I think so, yeah. Seems like it. If you put it at the beginning, then by default it's an intro.
There we go. Cut it. Print it. Hey everyone, welcome again to the Wanna Watch podcast. It's 2021, but we're recording this still in lockdown in 2020. So I hope that we're all vaccinated or not, and we're living our best lives over there in the future. So today we're going to be talking about the Akira Kurosawa bloody classic, Seven Samurai. I'm joined, as ever, by my co-host with the mo-host, Luke Bean. Hello, Luke.
Hello, Hamza. Welcome. Hello, 2021.
Hey. And today we're also joined by Aki. He's a very good friend of mine. He's an actor and all that good stuff. So, Aki, if you could just kind of give us a general lowdown of how's it going, who are you, what you've been up to, in this strange lockdown year of 2020
and airing in 2021. Yes, I'm a actor. I'm on Aki Katabi at everything. I mainly audition for things, and when they put me in them, I do them. but just keep going and enjoy, I guess. Yeah, I enjoy being on set. I enjoy filmmaking. I enjoy being part of all that. So glad to be here.
It's great. Like, you're one of the actors that I spot in things now and again. And my favorite one was, I was like completely like balls deep in a fucking marathon of Mad Men. Like, I was watching like three episodes a night, because I think I watched it once. I watched like the first episode when it first came out, like, when it premiered, and I was like, why do I care about all these rich motherfuckers? And then like people kept saying it's great. So then I finally went back and watched it, I think around the time the last series was airing in America. And yeah, I was just watching it constantly. And then suddenly at like, I don't know, 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm watching an episode and there you were. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, it kind of blew my mind. I was loving life.
It's like surreal. It makes you lose the, I feel like whenever I see friends or myself in anything, it destroys the imaginator.
Totally.
Like
I was just watching you the whole time.
It just makes you go, what? Mad. That's my friend. Like if I saw you in a film, yeah. It just drops the fictional side, yeah, a little bit.
It's just funny because I've seen you a few times now in a few different things, and I'm just, every time I see you, I'm just like, yeah, man, he's doing it, fucking great.
We'll definitely
talk more about that. So before we begin, let me just give a brief intro to the film for anyone that hasn't seen it, but we do talk spoilers, so if you haven't seen it, I mean, you know, it's a pretty simple story, but I would strongly suggest that you go check it out because it is a classic and you wouldn't want to see this for the first time and it already be ruined. So, Seven Samurai, one of the most thrilling movie epics of all time, Seven Samurai, or I'm going to tear apart this Japanese, but Shichijin no Samurai, tells the story of a 16th century village whose desperate inhabitants hire the eponymous warriors to protect them from invading bandits. This three-hour ride from Akira Kurosawa, featuring legendary actors Toshirô Mifune and Takeshi Shimura, seamlessly weaves philosophy and entertainment, delicate human emotions, and relentless action into a rich, evocative, and unforgettable tale of courage and hope. So yeah, that's the film. It's definitely one of my favorites, like, is up there with all the big ones. So yeah, first off, I've seen it. Luke, have you seen it before?
Yeah, I have.
Cool. And then Aki, this is your first time. So yeah. First off, Aki, what did you think on your first ever watch of this classic film, this staple of cinema?
You know, when I started watching, I will say it's great. First off, it's long. It had an intermission.
Yeah. which I took advantage of as well.
I feel like the last film that had an intermission was Schindler's List that I remember watching in a theater and actually leaving. Yeah, like you have to, not leaving, but like, I'm like, oh, you're supposed to leave now. Yeah. But my first thoughts were, I'd heard so much about this. I feel like I may have tried to start watching it a couple times before.
Right.
But I quite liked that. I don't know, like whenever I watch anything that's even just not current, like right now, I'm always surprised how much slower everything can start. And appreciated it, like settles you in a sense. I'm like, okay, back to like even just the titles and this taiko drumming. It went on for just to start. But it set me into a, it kind of sets you into a different mood, which I liked, instead of like flashbang, ADD, explosions, I don't know, Marvel, everyone's dying and then the thing starts with some rap music playing or something. Yeah.
It's quite meditative.
I probably watched it just thinking, well, I keep hearing, you know, so many elements of this film are in so many movies now. So I think, sadly, instead of being just totally in the story, I was constantly thinking that,
right, yeah,
okay, a bit as I watched, and I was like, what of this and that is I was curious more, like what elements, because I remember thinking, well, there's a lot of close-ups. I also remember thinking the acting seemed quite real. Yeah. Toshiro Mifune is
oh my god,
is a zany guy. And I mean he's a great, it was, yeah. So other than, I really liked, as you, the second guy, you said the Takashi Shimura.
Yeah.
His character seemed quite grounded and real. And I found it, I guess it was a good example of like kind of real act. I don't know how to say it. Not like stagey feeling, yeah, acting.
Naturalistic.
And always, whenever I watch films and know there was no CG, I'm always like, man, it must have been tough. Yeah. Like, I didn't know until you told me late about the, you know, final scenes in February and all that. But I was thinking just the amount of people, and I didn't really know how they got their angles until I looked at it later. But just it's on film. It's real. They're acting with horses. Toshiro Mifune is like kicking at horses at one point, I thought. So I just found it really, I don't know, it made me kind of, some part of me to yearn to be able to be on some sort of set like that, where it's just, there's so much real practical, I guess you'd call it now, stuff, and you gotta just nail it.
Oh, yeah.
I think that must have been a type of pressure I've not had as much, unless I go on stage, which is rare. So so that was my overall feeling, and it had, and I felt like there was probably a lot of hidden kind of meaning, because it's quite a simple story in a sense.
Definitely.
You know, seven samurai are going to protect this village from bandits, but in the meantime there's all the things that were happening on the side, and there were all these kind of almost like, kind of like how the movie ends, like Confucius type.
Oh yeah.
Sayings that were interesting to me in there.
Yeah, definitely. I think this is a film where Kurosawa was talking about, you know, status and culture and society. And definitely there's a lot more going on than just the kind of simple story. But I think that's why, you know, simple stories are sometimes great to then explore
much wider themes. I think he definitely does that. And like, just we'll get back to some of your points, because you said some really interesting stuff, particularly. I'd love to talk about some of the stuff that this film does for the first time that now, like, if you watch it now, you just think, oh yeah, that, but like, that was the first time it was ever done.
Yeah, I would like to know more than what I read.
Yeah, there's loads on that, yeah. So Luke, what did you think on your, I guess, second watch, or however many times you watched it?
Yeah, this is my second watch. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It's super long. It's like 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the intermission and the music in the middle as well. Yeah, it's, and I had that same thing of the different bits that you now recognize are sort of turned into tropes in certain films, like heist movies. That was the first time that it's ever been done on film, so that was really interesting. I like fantasy settings and historical things like this, because I just find different cultures and also different honor systems really interesting. So I always find that really interesting. Like, I definitely wouldn't want to live in a feudal period, but as like a place to have an adventure, it's perfect, because you've got all these different roles, and like, you know, there's drama in it as well, of like the farmers and the samurai and the bandits. It's all like interacts. So that was super interesting. Yeah, and it's like, it looks amazing. Just what he did to get all these different shots, and for the time period as well, when it was made. Yeah, it was cool. And I loved all the different characters, the characterizations of the different samurai and the farmers as well.
I was thinking about that. I did like, also, I think it was when Toshiro Mifune kind of reveals where his origins may be in that speech. He doesn't make the samurai all seem so honorable, even though they live by a code of honor, but there still is that they could, you know, just take supplies from a village, or maybe, you know, plunder the women and stuff like that, because I think that was part of it. And it's kind of good that they showed it from that point. It's not that they're just like these super noble knights.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, because Kurosawa is from the samurai. Like, he is from like the samurai caste, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, he's a descendant of. Yeah, exactly. And it is really interesting, those few moments when, I think there's two main moments when sort of Mifune's character kind of reveals himself truly. And that's one of it. And his acting is just so, I mean, we'll talk more about him, but that, in both those scenes, that scene when he talks about why those villagers act like they do, and then one of the best bits of the whole film is when they're saving that child from the burning thing, and then he kind of realizes that, oh my god, this happened to me. And it's just like, oh, especially because he's the kind of comic relief, but then every so often he'll do something and he's just like, oh my god, that is like, he's such an interesting character. And I mean, it was just going to be 6 samurai, and as they were writing it, they realized that this film would have been very kind of boring. Well, not boring, but it just would have been the same tone. They would have just been a very simple story, and all the samurai would have acted a certain way. So they need a wild card. And I think
he's the guy to do it, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like, Kurosawa encouraged him to kind of to improvise and mess around, and like, and you can see that, like, there's so many things where you can just see he's just messing about, just kind of, as some of Luke's previous special guests from his clown course would say, he's a clown
throughout the film. Yeah, totally.
Totally, totally. And it's funny, because as I was watching it, I was thinking, oh, there's some clown.
Maybe that's why it seemed real to me, or it wasn't so scripted then.
Oh, it wasn't, no.
He reminds me of Dr. Brown. Dr. Brown, you know, Phil Burgess.
Okay, yeah, I can see that. Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, definitely. And so this is probably, I think, my third or fourth watch. It's not a film that I can just put on at any time, personally. I love it, but it's not, you know, it's so epic, and it's so, like, you can't really watch this film and, like, I don't know, do your tax return or anything. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you have to sit down, and it's 3.5 hours long, nearly, with the intermission, So I haven't watched it that many times, but every time I do, it's like a treat. And as soon as Aki, you said this, I was like, yes, like I kind of, it was time to watch. It was high time I watched it. And I'm actually writing a kind of martial arts film at the moment. Well, generating ideas for one. And so again, the storytelling in this, in my opinion, is top notch. And I think this is the first time I watched it really with a real kind of analytical eye. Like one, I was watching this film and enjoying it completely, but there was another part of me that was just admiring the fucking brushstrokes, like the shot selection, the even the sound, like everything about it is just perfect. Like it's really is a perfect film.
The thing I noticed with this with the music, the it goes like boom boom boom,
yeah,
boom 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 boom. I just started count because it happened so often. I counted and I realized it was 3 drum beats and then 7. And then like, oh, it's 3 and 7. And then they have 3 samurai go into that one village, and then it's 7 total.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the intentional meaning, but I was like, okay, maybe there's meaning to that.
Well, also, only 3 of them survive as well.
Ah, right.
Yeah. So that's crazy.
Right.
And yeah so the composer was someone that Kurosawa worked with many times. And this was I think it was either his last or second to last. And he died of tuberculosis, like while they were shooting this film.
Oh.
And so, yeah, I didn't know that before. I did a lot of research after watching it, and like, yeah, it's just interesting, like, because I was definitely aware of the music and how the drum beats were used and where they were used and stuff and how they were used. It was really cool. And yeah, I just loved it. I loved it as much as I did the first time. And there were certain things that just stuck out to me that I just remember. And particularly Mifune's like second entrance, like he's in a scene earlier, but it's that when they go, he's like a wild dog, and then he just comes in drunk, and then they do the test, and he gets hit on the head, and then he just chases that guy. It's just not a great entrances of any character ever. I fucking love that shit. And he is like a wild dog throughout the whole film. He's just this wild guy.
That's just definitely running around. True.
So yeah, so what I thought would be interesting is like the kind of groundbreaking side. So what did you guys sort of spot that you thought this is the first time? Like for me, one of the things that I noticed was that this is the first, I'm assuming this is one of the first films where you put a team together, like you get it now in Mission Impossible films and like all those kind of team movies. This is the first one where it's like he spends like a long time, and a really cool way of doing it, of finding his crack team of samurai.
It's quite effective too, because you then care, you get to know each person, I guess. Each person had different traits to them.
Totally.
That's cool. I really like that sword master found mid-duel.
Oh my god. He was so awesome. I loved when he brings the gun, and the way he just goes, I killed 2, and then sits down. And he's not even doing it with any ego. He's just like, I killed 2. That's the information you need. Yeah. Here's the gun. I'm going to sit down. And then what adds to it even more is when the young samurai kind of goes, oh, you're really great. And he kind of walks off. And then just for a second, he smiles. Oh, my God. I just fucking love that, man. That's perfect shit. That's great. Well, what else did you? What else kind of shouted out to you guys in terms of like groundbreaking shit or stuff that probably is the first time?
I don't know what is groundbreaking or not, but I felt like, I guess the continuousness to the coverage of, maybe all the close-up shots. I don't know often done before, but it was a lot of face. And then another face instead of being like 4 people in a more play type setup, I guess.
Kurosawa,
is great at master shots, but this is the first time that he used like a telephoto lens. So like he often would have like 2-3 cameras going at once, and that's where you get these amazing close-ups and like, and especially the action stuff at the end. Like that was all like 3 cameras running, doing all this shit, and it was all it was all kind of improvised. Like they didn't plan it too much because he wanted it to be like a real battle. So
what with 3 cameras in the and improvised. That sounds kind of crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it took a long time to shoot. It took a long time to shoot because I think originally they were planned to shoot the action stuff in the summer, and then it just dragged out. I think they shot, they closed down production. Toho Studios stopped production for like 3 different times,
right.
And each time, I love this story. Each time, Kurosawa just said, all right, cool, and then just went fishing, knowing that they'd spent so much money that there's no way they're not going to give him more money.
Just went fish. I mean, well, yeah, what are you going to do? I guess,
yeah, exactly. Fishing. Exactly. Yeah. And yeah, like, I think, like, the, you know, when the character played by Takeshi Shimura, like, when he is introduced, like through action, like he's doing something, that was again the first time that character has been introduced where he's already doing something and you see him do something and then that's unrelated to the main quest and stuff.
What was he he was introduced when he was shaving his head, is that how
exactly
it started?
Which is
a weird thing that. For it's not cool to not have your top knot in those days.
It just shows what kind of character he is, that he was willing to shave his head, which is like so not cool. Like, and I love that his hair grows. I think this is the first time where I truly realized that his hair grows throughout the film, and by the end he's got like a bit of a kind of buzz cut look going on. It's a great little touch. And also, like, I think the way that the action scenes were shot as well, like where you've got kind of a mixture of slow-mo and kind of normal motion and like master shots with close-ups in action.
Right.
That was like the first time that stuff had been done. And it's just influenced everything. Like, you know, it was remade into the Magnificent Seven. It's got influences in Star Wars and just everywhere. Like it's one of those kind of touchstones of particularly action cinema.
Yeah, I've always heard that. What are the influences to say Star Wars? I guess accumulation of a gang and.
Well, there's a more interesting story about that, which is so he made a film called The Hidden Fortress, and The Hidden Fortress was remade into the first Star Wars film in a way. It's literally about these two kind of so the droids are like two servants, and it's like a samurai, which is Obi-Wan, and a young guy. Which they're trying to like save a princess, and like it's and it opens with them kind of running around the droids with a message and stuff. So yeah, it's pretty much like the story. Yeah, it's a great film as well. Actually, like definitely worth checking out. Hidden Fortress.
The Hidden Fortress. Yeah, I'm gonna have to start watching more.
Oh yeah. He's got lots of good stuff. Like Yojimbo was remade into A Fistful of Dollars. And it's the exact same story. So a lot of his films, were remade and done differently. And and they're just as valid. Like, you know, I mean, I'd say Magnificent Seven isn't nearly as good as this, but like Fistful of Dollars is amazing in its own right. And obviously Star Wars is amazing in its own right. And it for me surpasses Hidden Fortress, even though Hidden Fortress is great. And Luke, was there anything you thought about in terms of when you were watching it and you thought, oh wow, this is like first time this is done?
Yeah, well, mainly it was that same thing of that getting the gang together, that's been like, that's just like it's such a useful idea in this. That is part of the movie that, you know, that like they're trying to find a samurai that will actually help them, and then also his the lead samurai, then he still has to find other samurai that are going to help him for food because that's all they can pay them. And then you get to see their characterization and the fact that there's like the different, like him and his mates, they're looking for different samurai. And also it's a good way to to introduce what is his name? Toshiro Mifune, his name is Kikuchiyo, like as like a way for him to sort of like come in and then be a bit of a wild card. Whereas like it's interesting because a lot of films that's turned into such a useful trope that it's done like it's used as shorthand. So you see a man throwing a knife at a wooden board and you go, hey, we've got a job for you. So yeah, I'm in. It makes me think about, I just watched the fourth season of Rick and Morty and there's a thing in that about
heists. I was literally going to ask you if you saw that. Yeah.
It's like, it's become such a trope that, you know, it's a joke and sometimes people use it without there being a story reason. It's just a quick way to like get people together. So that, I mean, that's really interesting to think about.
Right.
As far, I mean, that's all like, as far as like kind of, I'm sure there's other stuff. I knew that Hidden Fortress, I haven't seen Hidden Fortress, but I do want to see it because I want to see the influence it had on Star Wars. And I think that just the drama of it, like it portrays, it seems like it should be like a stage play as well as like a movie.
Yeah, it's definitely like very, I found there's lots of like pathos, lots of moments of like emotion where you're just kind of caught up in something. And, you know, like there's loads of times when other films would just focus on the action and the what they're doing. But like there's plenty of room in this film in its 3.5 hour running time for like actual emotion. Like the only part that I, that doesn't quite work for me is the young samurai and the girl. Like, it works.
You know, they're all right.
Yeah, it works kind of. I get what it's doing, but I don't know, maybe because their chemistry wasn't that great. Like, I just, it didn't really, as a story, work for me. But everything else, you know, each time one of them died, it really, every time it is like, fuck. And I knew that, that Toshiro Mifune's character dies. And as I remembered it, as we got to the final battle, I was like, man, this is going to suck. And it did. It did really suck when he died. Because, yeah, you kind of grow to really... I mean, I do anyway.
I didn't think he was going to die. Yeah, I didn't think they would... Yeah, I was surprised, actually. But...
Yeah.
Then he survives long enough to make that one last...
yeah, man, takes out the leader, I guess. Takes out the leader proper, like and yeah, let's talk about his performance. Like he's just wild, isn't he? It's just crazy, like the stuff he's doing. And as a performer, I really appreciate it because I've seen people try and act wild, and it just comes off weird and out of control. But he's totally in control in this incredible way. Like even the way there's a bit where he kind of falls over, and he's embarrassed when falls off the horse. And the way he kind of gets up is incredible. Like, even just the way he moves his body to get up is incredible. Like, he acts with his whole body. He's like he's like a Brando, but kind of funny.
Funny. That's funny.
And it's like, because his sort of, a lot of his other films, he's quite kind of stoic and badass.
I feel like I remember seeing something. I hadn't seen that much of his film, but it was something where it was like him and another guy, and it was after the war, and they're stuck on an island.
Oh, Hell in the Pacific. Him and Lee Marvin. Yeah, man. That's a great film.
And I thought it's a very different performance.
And what's interesting about that is both of those guys did fight on opposite sides of World War II. Lee Marvin was like a war hero in World War II.
Oh, shoot.
And,
right.
And Mifune was was a photographer, but he was still, you know, on the front lines.
Right.
Crazy. Mm. And then, that's a great film as well. But yeah, that is a perfect example of the kind of stuff he mostly does in films. Is he has like character. He's an incredible emotive actor with his face, with his body. But he's, you know, he's more like the kind of the character who's like super skilled swordsman. Like originally he was going to play that part. And for him to pull this off and do it so well, and he brings so many brushstrokes to this performance where he's like fucking so like enjoyable, like you're just kind of enjoying everything he's doing. And then in the moments where he's doing something dramatic, he really delivers. And
his facial expressions and his close-ups are incredible, and he looks great. His face is amazing.
You're making me, I'm just realizing now, actually, the we're earlier talking about video games in Ghost of Tsushima. Yeah, you basically assemble a team. And I was thinking, there is a Joker guy. He's like a sake dealer guy who's always getting into trouble. And I was like, oh, yeah, there's like all those funny guys in there. But the sake, And I don't want to give up too much about that game, but yeah.
Yeah, I need to. That's definitely on my list of things to check out ASAP. And like, the kind of socio-economic stuff. Did you pick up on much on that since this is your first watch, or were you just enjoying the kind of story side of it?
You mean between farmers, samurai, bandits,
and bandits and all that?
I mean. I guess I know a bit about, the samurai. I mean, times were tough, I believe. I was actually still thinking about something you said about moments that I did like. And
yeah, what else did you like?
I was thinking the part where they go to the bandits and then there's a woman, and maybe I was missing this earlier, but she seems to be rescued and then she goes back into the burning house.
Oh, yeah. Fuck, yeah.
And only kind of later or through inference, I figured out, you know, she was captured, but she was his. She didn't want to live with the shame of having been like disgraced.
Yeah.
And I was thinking that's that dishonor business. I guess that I found quite interesting. And even what you said, where you said you found it didn't really work for you with the young samurai. I forget his name, but what's it? Katsushiro?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that sounds right.
And the girl, it could be there's a lot of like unspoken stuff in Japanese culture, and I didn't find it I really liked actually the end when they just had a glance and she carried on to continue her song, and I found, at least for me, that part worked.
That part definitely worked. That was great.
You
totally understood it as well.
So I was just going to say that there's a word in Japanese for it, isn't there? There's like the stuff that you say and then the stuff that you don't say. Like there is actually words for it in Japanese, but I don't know.
There's like kind of two faces that you can show. I guess there's a honne and tatemae. I mean, tatemae is the face you show. So if you go to a McDonald's in Japan, someone will, you know, go, "Irashaimase, welcome to McDonald's. How can I help you? Happy, happy, happy." And then there's the true feeling, which is the honne. And I guess, I don't know if there was, so I guess there's those two ways, but that's around in other cultures as well, I think.
Yeah, it's just in Korean as well,
differently. Yeah, I don't know them as much, but yes, and there's something a lot more to do with that aged thing. A respect for age.
Oh yeah. I mean, I was there for 2 years, but I've been learning Korean for I think like 5 years now. And so the word for it in Korean is nunchi, which literally means eye reading or like eye measure. So you're supposed to the onus is on the listener to make sense of what someone's saying. So like if I did something that annoyed another teacher, they would never ever say to me that's wrong. They would always do it in a side way, and then they would never press it. Even when I was like, I mean, it's really hard to kind of get your head around because the levels of what is acceptable to say. But like, I was trying to speak to a guy in Korean to practice my Korean at this nightclub, just like hanging out in this social group, and then he said like, "Oh yeah, it's kind of weird that I'm speaking to you in English and you're speaking to me in Korean." But that was him saying like, shut up, speak English, because I don't want to speak Korean to you. But he would never ever say that. He would just be like, "Oh, it's kind of funny that you're doing this, isn't it?" And that was like the level of him, which, I mean, he was just a stranger that I was talking to. But yeah, it's kind of exhausting when like you first go over and you have to acclimatize to that culture, because you expect people are going to tell you stuff and they never, ever will.
I guess it's a lot of inference. I was thinking, I mean, my parents are Japanese, but I grew up in the States, so I also had to study about it. But the amount of politeness levels to the language, and then the example you gave reminded me of, I hear about people that they won't fire them, but they'll just stop giving them things they need to do so that they realize they should quit.
Oh, wow.
And I was thinking, yeah, that's it's very indirect way of doing things.
Yeah,
which isn't very good if you have like a pilot in command who has mistakenly all like got the altitude wrong, but the co-pilot never will say anything. They'll just crash the I don't know if that's true, but
are you talking about the story from Outliers with the Korean pilot?
I've read an example
but I was thinking,
so for the audience, that basically what because of the deferential nature of kind of Korean culture, the co-pilot and the pilot, I mean, I think it's more to do with age than it is status, but like the pilot was older and he was doing the wrong thing. I think it's that. Yeah, I'm sure I've read it as well, but it was a lot when it first came out. But it's something to do with, because of the deferential nature of it, like
it just didn't...
more planes that had Korean pilots were crashing because they wouldn't correct their pilot, and they wouldn't kind of say, look, this is wrong. And so more and more planes were crashing, and they didn't realize why until someone kind of studied it and figured out that it was just that they wouldn't say anything.
I actually couldn't remember. Well, thank you for placing that, if that is from that book.
Yeah, it's definitely from Outliers by, what's his name?
Malcolm Gladwell.
Yeah. Great book. Really, really great book. That definitely, like, that thing of... having two faces is really interesting.
Yes, I didn't really notice it as a, I guess, socioeconomically. I know that samurai, especially with masters, are of a higher class than farmers, and obviously bandits are not good. but Ronin or masterless samurai are an interesting breed, because I don't think they're supposed to really become farmers or anything. They still study their craft, but they don't really have a master, so they kind of wander. So it's a weird state, I guess.
Well, aren't they technically supposed to commit?
Because they weren't allowed to.
I thought they were supposed to.
Yeah, I guess that's true. So they, I don't know if they always had to, but yeah, you're right. I think if your master loses, you're supposed to lose along with them. So I guess the ones that became Ronin were like, no thanks. don't want to gut myself.
That was another thing about the film, where it's like this was the one of the first films to show samurai as just like normal dudes, rather than like high drama where they're like cutting themselves open and stuff. Yeah. and like being these like ideal heroes with
all the white paper. They always had all that white paper to cut their subs in the blood. It's what I also remember, just white kimono or white, you know, clothing, white paper, cut yourself, the blood's like art as you're dying. Totally different.
This beautiful spray. Totally beautiful spray hitting this white paper wall or something. Yeah, and like the idea that all the characters are essentially losers, like they're all people that have lost battles, and like particularly the main
it kind of reminds me of the Alamo. I grew up in Texas, so there's a story about the Alamo where we glorify these people that protected this fort, but they actually, if you look into the characters of the people there, they weren't the greatest people. They were, even though they're turned into big heroes, and you know, there's like the Bowie knife from Jim Bowie and all this, but yeah, it made the samurai more like they're also people with problems, especially ones without masters. Sorry, yeah. I just went on a tangent, but yeah.
I think that's really interesting because everyone's kind of trapped by their social roles. Because you think if you're a samurai, that means you have to die in battle or you have to kill yourself. And it's like some people, if you're born that, you know, into that caste, you wouldn't want to do that. Like some people would just want to work on a farm and, you know, look after themselves. Yeah. And then some peasants, you know, a lot of them were sort of shown as quite cowardly, but some of them did kind of, you know, stick up for themselves and kind of like, you know, argue the point that they needed to protect themselves. So it's like that's why that ending is so sad, where the farmer's daughter and the young samurai, like there's not even any point them having a conversation, because it's like they're aliens from different planets that can't breathe the same air. Like the idea that he would he would put down his sword and start farming is completely impossible. And the idea that he would somehow be able to take her home is also just completely impossible. And it's like how the social rules just kind of get in the way of the humanity of the characters.
I see. Yes, that is correct.
And it makes you realize why the dad was so aggressively against it. Cause at first you're kind of watching it thinking it's just about, he doesn't want his daughter to get railed, but actually it's like, it's more to do with there's no future in it. So it is just like, yeah, he's protecting.
There's no future. And then she's de-virginized, I guess.
Yeah, too. Exactly. Yeah.
And it did, cause we watched, go on.
Sorry. Oh,
are you going to say something, Aki?
No, sorry. I just coughed.
I think there's a bit of a delay on the Zoom call tonight, but I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah, no.
Definitely is, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's fine. We'll edit out the delays or put some more in, if that sounds better. I was just going to say, because we watched Orlando recently, which is like, kind of, it goes through different time periods, but there's a bit in the Elizabethan period, and I was reading about it, where they had sumptuary laws that the Queen Elizabeth tightened them up, and it was like, it was because there was like a rising middle class where suddenly, you know, merchants and people had money, merchants could dress just as well as nobles, and so they were really strict on, you know, it was illegal for you to wear certain furs, like ermine was only for dukes and up, and stuff like that. And so it's like, you know,
to like differentiate the right.
Yeah, exactly. To
differentiate the.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. And, but even some of it was interestingly political, because there were colors that people were wearing, and it was, that was like foreign dyes that were made in Germany. And she was annoyed at, like, she didn't want money leaving the country, going to Germany to pay for these foreign colors. So she sort of banned I don't know what it was, but if it was like purple or whatever, because that was being bought outside of the country. So there's this interesting kind of big political side to it as well. But also, it, you know, like, there are laws about what women wear and what men can wear. And it's like, that's why it's interesting at the beginning that, Kanbei, like he cuts off his, like the top knot, like his hair that he's got, that basically shows that he's a samurai. And it's like, that's how you know he's a kind of he's a noble dude, because he's not bothered about the appearance. He will just shave his head like a monk, even though, you know, that would be like that'd be kind of like getting rid of your kind of like royal robes or something like that, or your soldiers' medals or whatever. Kind of like, it's kind of interesting to think what that signifies, because also I think, wasn't it was like legal for samurai to cut down, like you could kill a peasant if you're a samurai, and there were no legal repercussions.
So yeah, it's like, they could just kill him.
Yeah, which is like,
I think, geez, they could just kill him. Yeah.
And then that, because I think there was an incident that I remember reading about, because I was like, kind of, there's this really cool YouTube channel. I can't remember what it's called, but it reads primary text from history, and there's a Japanese diplomat who visited America. He was like, the first, Japanese diplomat to visit America. And it's interesting to hear the dude reading his diary. But there was an incident in 1862 where this British merchant was riding along, a samurai was coming the other way, and then the British merchant right. didn't get down off of his horse, which he should have done, and the samurai just killed him, basically. And like there was this, it was this massive diplomatic called the Namamugi incident.
Right.
It was like sort of this big, you know, because obviously the British didn't want one of their citizens cutting down.
Well, yeah.
It was like crazy, man. Technically, that was legal for him to do that, like under that sort of Japanese law of the time.
1862, yeah, before the Meiji Restoration. Crazy times. You're right. Don't want to be in feudal Japan. You just get...
Yeah. You know, I always think about, sometimes I like to think about when I'm stuffing my face with KFC that this is better than any meal that anyone could have got 100 years ago. Like just a standard two-piece, three-piece KFC meal is better than any meal that Henry VIII ever had in his entire life, probably.
Henry VIII, well, didn't they have all those turkeys and birds, the kings? I guess
yeah, that's just roasted, isn't it?
It's not fried. It would have been just straight up. Yeah,
no taste, no flavor.
Maybe salt. Yeah,
maybe salt. But yeah, just a touch of salt because salt was just so expensive as well.
That is true.
Yeah, I always like to think of that as to make myself feel better as I cry into my KFC.
I think there's something I read in one of the Stephen King, the Dark Tower series, where the gunslinger from this fictional world drinks a Coke. And it blows his mind.
Like that's so cool.
The sugar of the Coke. I mean, he feels like it's like a magic tonic.
Yeah, I remember I didn't eat any kind of fast food like on purpose. I was like, right, I'm just going to eat well. And for about 2 years, I didn't eat any kind of fast food. I just ate kind of good stuff. And I think I was like maybe 19, 18, something like that. And it had been 2 years or something. And then... I think I was like somewhere up central London and I had like an hour to kill. And I was like, all right, let me just go have a McDonald's. Mm-hmm. And I walked in and it was like being hypnotized because I hadn't been around that for so long that I was really sensitive. So like the burst of colors in your eyes, the music's like not loud, but it's not soft. So it's like at this frequency that is kind of like hypnotic. And then I remember I ate the food and immediately my entire mouth went completely dry because it was so salty. And then I drank the Coke and it was so much sugar that I went high. And I just remember walking out of there, just kind of, I felt like, I don't know what had just happened to me. Like I'd been drugged or something. It's crazy. Like when you don't partake in that kind of stuff for a while, how your body is not used to it. And yeah, I had the similar effect to that character in Dark Tower where it just kind of blew my mind. I was like drugged up.
Yeah, that's billions served, right?
And I'm guessing the millet didn't have quite the same effect.
Apparently that's rubbish.
I did Google up what millet exactly was.
What is
it?
It's
like, it's just like weird wheat chaff type things. Various grains can be millet. So it doesn't have to just be the kernels of rice. But
so basically it's the stuff that now like is very expensive that you have to buy like online.
Health food stuff, yeah.
Trail mix and shit. For rich people.
Well, I think it's more the stuff that it's like the wheat that you would make, the like building blocks for making bread. Basic, or like I guess oatmeal or porridge could be kind of closer, probably stone. What is that? That steel cut oats? So I do remember. Yeah, I was thinking. Actually, what you were saying that made me think about the lockdown. Like during lockdown, I had to cook. I cooked a lot. I like cooking, and I was cooking at home and trying to. I mean, I watched all those cooking shows, and I was like, you know, I'm going to be seasoning like the restaurants and. Just butter it up and da 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 da. But then when things opened up and I went to eat, like McDonald's or takeaway, even it was like, whoa, they really do season it, don't they?
Yeah.
I thought I was going
heavy,
that's why you have to buy so much salt and sugar to.
Well, it's to hide the taste of the low quality food of any restaurant. Like I often, because my background is Kashmiri, Pakistani. So lots of curries and stuff. And it always kind of blew my mind why the food at home
was so much better than any restaurant I could go to other than the odd one. And then my dad just went, because they're built, they're cooking for like a mass, so they don't use the best ingredients. They don't take the care that
You got to make money too. Yeah. I was thinking about it.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's definitely, I mean, I often sometimes think, well, I can make this dish pretty well. Maybe I should sell it. But then you start thinking, but you kind of want to make some money selling it, right? First off, then how do you go about doing that? If you start going down that rabbit hole, you're like, well, you don't get the organic rice or the
Exactly.
So then
suddenly every plate costs like £25.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, maybe I won't do.
Yeah. I think,
I mean, you've been doing a lot of cooking, haven't you?
Yeah, I have actually. For dinner, I had barbuti, which is like a South African dish that I found on the BBC website. So it's, yeah.
Right.
It just tastes better, and I feel better after eating home cooked stuff as well. Because you know what you've put in it as well. Like, you know, you can season it to however much you want. And it is just, it's all like just fresh vegetable and then like, you know, decent meat. Yeah, but I was just thinking, there's this guy, Idris Shah, was this writer about Sufi Islam. Like Sufism is like a mystic kind of branch of Islam. I mean, that's a simple description of it, but I think he talked about baraka, which is like a holy energy. And that when someone cooks dinner, they're putting baraka into it. So it's like, I think there is an aspect of it as well. Like when you're cooking for your family or yourself, you're doing it and you're like paying attention, but like mass produced food is just, it's in a factory and it's frozen up and then it's sent out to a fast food joint or to somewhere. And it's like, there's no like love and care put into it. And so I think some of it is whether you believe in the mystical truth of it. I think that is a good description of like fast food has no baraka. It's got no like, you know, mystic energy put in it. It doesn't fill you up. It's probably like millet compared to rice, if we're to believe Seven Samurai's dietary analysis of what they're eating.
I mean, yeah, I do remember hearing my dad, I think when I was a kid, I sometimes would get full and not want to finish my rice or whatever food I had. And yeah, he once did tell me, you know, you're lucky, like we live in these times, like in those old times, the poor people would, you might harvest the rice, but you would have to make the white rice for the samurai or the honorable upper classes, and you eat the millet or the grains or the leftover scraps, and probably your teeth will be gone, like worn away from chewing. I think he kind of described it as like if you take sunflower seeds and you just chew the whole seed to get the inside and then spit out the shells. If you do that all the time, your teeth will be gone by the time you're 30. And I was like, I didn't care. I was like, well, I'm full, Dad. I don't want to eat
the rice. Thanks but, for the story, Dad. I'm not going to eat my rice.
But
I don't live in that time. So Dad.
I am thankful. I mean, thinking of like salt being rare is kind of, it really does show me the salt difference in, I was thinking about generations. My dad still will take, he'll like do things like dry the ocean water and collect the salt just for, I don't know if I can say for fun, but he's like, it tastes so good. And I'm like, it probably does.
That's amazing.
A lot of time too, but yeah. I like that baraka love put in the food.
That's, I like the sound of your dad's sea salt. Yeah, sea salt is salt. Good.
It's great. Yeah.
Because
it is, it looks so different from what I see in the store, though. It just doesn't look so clean. You dry ocean water. It looks more like some weird kind of gray, almost like white pepper stuff. But he that's one of the many things he does.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know if it's a generational thing, but sorry. Well, I know there's a delay. But yeah, I'm always impressed.
Yeah, fair. I mean, I would wonder about where to collect it from because, you know, some bits of the sea are not as clean as others. But what you were saying just made me think of it was quite eye-opening to work in South Korea, because obviously they had the Korean War that you don't really learn much about in the UK, because America was, you know, more involved with it. But one the principal of one of the schools that I taught in, we used to practice English. He would drive me around to the area, and this was in a school that had like 20 to 30 kids in the entire elementary school. It was like, you know, wow. Really tiny town. Wow. Like the town was literally like a square with these two kind of, you know, like two roads coming out of it. And that was pretty much it, with like the farms are all spread around the mountains. But there was a film that was shot in the mountains, and it's a tourist attraction because the buildings are still there and they look really similar to the buildings in Seven Samurai. Like it's from that time period. And he said, yeah, oh, wow. I grew up in a house like this. And he was like, that was his first year of being a principal. So he was like, he was young, like he was only like, I think he was like 40 something, like maybe late 40s. He wasn't super old. And he was saying he lived in a shack like that, and they ate potatoes. Like they literally ate potatoes because that's all they had. And I was like, geez, man, like, and now this dude's driving around in a car. In it, you know, with like, and they've got highways built through the, you know, drilled through mountains and stuff like that. Like this dude's life was, you know, what would you imagine life could be if you grew up as a kid in this country that had been destroyed by war, and you're just like literally eating potatoes because that's all you've got. Like it was an intense experience.
Time, I mean, things, I guess, change so quickly. If I think about, whether there's like the Irish potato famine, or, you know, what you're talking to me, or when you're saying that, I remember also as a kid, I feel like I have a lot of stories from when I was a kid. Like my dad, I used to hate the fat on a steak. Mm. I would cut the fat off. I was like, I don't want to become fat, so I don't eat the fat. Now I know a little bit better about all that. But he would tell me that his dad only could afford the fat. So as a treat. So sometimes they got some chunks of fat, which was a treat, and that's what you're throwing away. And I was like, yeah, that's what I'm throwing away. And I'm thinking, yeah, it really does. I guess I'm glad times can change.
Well, I think like that makes me think of like, yeah, like it's crazy to think in like two generations how much the world has changed. Like my great grandfathers that I've never met, like how different their lives are to me right now, talking on a computer to you guys in three different parts of the UK. Like I've recently got a new job, and it's just dawned on me that like at the moment, my new current day job, I have my boss is in Leicester, which is another part of England. And then like I'm running a team that work in Bulgaria, and like, you know, it's just a crazy thing. And to think, like, if I was to try and explain that to my great grandfather, he'd never understand, you know, like there's no way. And then I think like technology is moving at such a fast pace. Like imagine what my great grandchild, like what is that world going to be like? It's just, it's unimaginable. It's like truly unimaginable.
I mean, even if I was to go back to 1990 and try to explain to my 10-year-old self, like pretty soon you can pull up a phone from your pocket and call a cab or order food, he'd probably, you know, probably be like, yeah, right. I don't know what you're talking about. Why would you do, you need a phone cord I don't know. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. It's mad to think of it. Like the difference that, you know, even if you think about like, before the iPhone came out, like if you were to explain like a month before the iPhone came out, where we'd be now, it's just, again, unimaginable. And that wasn't even 10 years ago, you know?
Right. Is it really? The iPhone?
Yeah, wasn't it like 2010, something like that?
I don't know.
I don't even know. Yeah, whatever. It wasn't that long ago.
But yeah, you are right. I remember actually this time when I used to, I mean, it was, I guess, probably before an iPhone, I used to enjoy going to visit my grandparents in Japan because the cell phones were all goofy to me over there. I felt like in the States, we had these brick Nokias. Nokias. And yeah, speaking of something that you don't hear much of.
No, you don't.
They had the weirdest, it was, so, they were so tiny. Everyone loved these tiny little flip phones and little sliding phones. And I remember I was just like, whoa, it's so different. But now we're quite standardized, I feel.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's
so it was, very much the same. I did go to Japan last summer. I was thinking of how different times are then till now. And I was surprised how little, because I have a Samsung phone now, and I didn't find any Samsungs in Osaka.
Oh,
I
really? Saw
it, but I did find a Sony Walkman. Surprised me. Oh, nice. Yeah, and it had it was totally different to the Walkmans I knew as a kid. It wasn't a cassette player. It was like playing YouTube videos. But I was like, what in the world is that?
That's crazy.
Sony Walkman? That still exists? And there were a lot of Sharp phones, like Sharp Aquos phones, which I used to have a Sharp Aquos TV, but I was like, whoa, this it's the iPhone is still there, obviously. But I was surprised. I was like, oh yeah, I'm not seeing ads for Samsung. Interesting. Anyway.
I've got a Samsung as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a Samsung.
I mean, I literally bought it in Korea. I bought it in Korea. I had to get a phone there. So Samsung.
I'm guessing is there a lot of Samsung in Korea, I'm assuming?
Yeah.
And no Sony? No Sony?
I think so. Yeah, there's loads of Samsung, like all the Samsung TVs and stuff. Yeah. I mean, Korea wants to support its home business and stuff like that.
Of course. I was just curious. Whenever I go, I'm going to keep my eye out and see if Sony is just not there, just like in Japan. Samsung was seemed to be not easy to find. That'll be interesting. And then Apple is everywhere, which is funny.
Yeah, Apple's just everywhere. Yeah. They've taken over.
The thing about Korea is they've got Chaebols, which are like the big family-owned corporations like Samsung and Hyundai. But it's like they make everything. Like Hyundai, they were like trucks driving around everywhere in, you know, like in the countryside. But also I was like at a rest stop and I was in the toilets and the hinges were made by Hyundai. Like they were just these metal hinges. And it's like, because they're the manufacturers, and it's like Korea is a very sort of top-down society where there are a few companies that just do loads of things. So I would expect there to not be much Sony there.
Right. Yeah, got to get out there.
Definitely. Right, we're kind of coming to the end of our time, guys. So,
sorry, tangented on.
No, it's great. Yeah. It's great. That's what we're all about. That was my favorite part of the conversation, for sure. So, like, are there any final thoughts about what we've talked about the film or about anything we've talked about? Anything?
I guess to think of, we were just saying so much how much time has, how things changed through time. I mean, last year, this time was so different to right now.
Oh my God.
I was thinking. Yeah. But then on the other hand, we're also talking about a film, and yet we still see movies where it's like, oh, we have this common cause. Let's recruit 7 or so people. Yeah. And each person's got their characteristics, and we may come up and, so some things, I guess, I was just thinking, have stood the test of time. We still do phone calls sometimes and talk to each other
This is like a three-way phone call, isn't it?
Yeah, three-way. That was the thing. I remember being asking, I think my dad had to pay more for the phone to have three-way. He had to like hang up once to get the third person on the phone. This is the modern three-way with... I'm connected to a laptop. You could be on a phone. I don't know.
I'm on the laptop as well. Yeah. Yeah, you could totally be on a phone. Crazy.
You're on a headset. I'm on a Rode mic.
It's crazy.
We're still talking.
It's crazy to think about. So it. We're still doing it.
We're not clicking or ESPing our thoughts.
Yet. Not yet.
Yeah.
I mean, final thoughts from me is just Mifune, like, I just want to see more of his stuff, like, because I've seen a few of his films, but yeah, I feel like I need to complete that, because his performance as an actor, being a fellow actor, it kind of just showed me, like, yeah, you can act with your whole body, like all the gestures he did and his facial expressions. And
I'm going to definitely watch more Kurosawa now. Omri will be happy.
Yeah.
I think the problem was he introduced me to, I think he had this DVD of rare Kurosawa.
Oh,
so
wow.
I watched like these short stories. They were good, but they were like short movies that were kind of his like unreleased or B
oh, wow.
footage type things.
Yeah.
So I probably should, I'm going to go back and some of these, you know, like I haven't seen enough Toshiro Mifune myself, but to see Yojimbo or some of these will be.
Yojimbo is amazing. Sanjuro.
Yeah. So that'll be good to do.
Actually, this is always a good question. Like, as a performer, like, how did you get into acting, Aki?
I was a computer science major, and I didn't know what I was doing. And I thought I could be a skateboarder.
Oh,
I mean, I really liked skateboarding, and I liked playing music. But then somewhere I auditioned for something at the University of Texas just because I had nothing to do. And I was really, really bad, just as bad as I am at dancing. And I've never gotten into, I don't know, some part of me just wanted to try it out. So I decided I took a class outside of college. And that's when I actually first realized at like the age of 19, I think, that there's more than just memorizing the lines and looking like Brad Pitt. And so that intrigued me, that this analysis and this scene breakdown. So I think I looked at it from a kind of technical side, and I was getting really into it. And then that teacher at the end of that whole thing told me that I might be best suited behind the camera because
that's harsh.
Apparently I was really good at she was like, I can see you study well, and you broke down the scene, and you basically indicated to me every thing that you thought I would want to see, but you didn't really show me anything of you. And I remember that really pissed me off. So I took like a different class, but that's how it all started, probably from
I love that.
From being like, what the hell? I thought I was doing well. Was apparently, yeah. And so I think it was that chasing
this
point of view. And
over
time, I think I've started to figure out the point of view part. I don't know if I necessarily have figured out accents or characters in particular, but I like striving to get a point of view, I guess.
Yeah, it's like you're and kind playing of following.
Around.
You're kind of following the path that is sort of the more difficult. Like, there's maybe other things that people just go, oh yeah, do, but because someone told you no, you were like, well, I'm gonna fucking figure this out. Like, that's great.
That's
I love like, that.
I think that's the beginning, because the stage still scares me. I mean, I guess it's also trying to do stuff that scares you, like skateboarding to land a trick scared me. Jumping off a high cliff would scare me. I'm going to skydive one day, you know, that kind of thing. So
amazing.
And but I love it, but it is, but it, yeah, it is fun. It's great.
How did you end up in England?
So Texas, I went and taught English in Japan because I ended up with a degree in Asian studies there. I met a British girl,
and that was that.
I brought her to LA, and then I moved here, and we've parted, but I've remained. And
you're loving life as much as
you can. Yeah, I'm happy to be here with my girlfriend now.
Awesome. And I've met her, and she's lovely. And awesome.
Yeah, we came to Avocado.
Yeah, man, it was great.
You told her I'm one of your biggest fans.
Yeah, man. We definitely owe you some drinks.
No. Oh, I quit drinking too, actually.
Oh, yeah. I remember you saying. Yeah.
So, but I'll happily eat some food.
yeah, or man,
drink a non-alcoholic
definitely
beer.
Do that. But, yeah, we'll definitely get together.
Yeah,
I want to go down to New Malden when everything opens up. I want to go because there's some, there's like a South Korean population. There's actually a North Korean population there as well in New Malden, and there's loads of restaurants down there. So I want to go and get some proper Korean food.
Yeah,
so
we can get some kimchi jjigae. Is one of my favorite
stores. Oh, really? Nice, nice.
You know what place? If you're in near here in Finsbury Park, there's a place called Dotori, which I think means acorn in Korean, and they do pretty good Korean food, actually.
Oh, okay, that sounds cool. Yeah.
So, any final thoughts from you, Luke, before we wrap it up? Because we should now.
Yeah, I love the swordsman in it. I love like Beat Takeshi's Zatoichi as well. Like, I love idea of you being so good at something that you can just size someone up and say like, "Oh yeah, I can beat you." I love that. And the other thing that I really really love. The film that Akira Kurosawa did called Ikiru, which is like...
That's one I haven't seen.
That
we'll have to put on the list.
Yeah, that's amazing. So I won't say anything more about it, but that's one of my favorite movies. Like,
for that.
Basically. That is amazing. It's so beautiful. Cool. So I recommend that, yeah, like if you want to see some more of him. But yeah, man, I fucking love that film, Ikiru. I want to rewatch it after watching Seven Samurai.
Ah, and I'll say it's a Shichinin no Samurai.
Shichinin
is just seven dudes, seven humans, I guess. The Chinese characters would be seven human, and then no means of. Seven human of samurai. Shichinin no Samurai.
Nin is the counter for people.
Yeah.
Or samurai.
Just a random thing I heard at the beginning, and I was like,
but I mean,
I can make a fake Japanese version of Shichinin no Samurai. I said that kind of thing.
Ah, brilliant.
Yeah.
That's great.